Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news.
We'll begin with an ironic approach to reining in campaign spending with the formation of the May Day Super PAC designed to support pro-campaign finance reform politicians. Lawrence Lessig, the director of the Edmund J. Safra Foundation Center for Ethics at Harvard University and co-founder of the May Day Super PAC with former George W. Bush advisor Mark McKinnon, joins us to discuss their PAC's growing crowd-funded war chest and the candidates they are helping in this year's midterm election. Then we will speak with Dr. Stephen Cohen, a professor of Russian Studies and History at New York University and professor of Politics Emeritus at Princeton University, about his editorial, co-written with Katrina Vandenhoevel, War with Russia? Kiev's Siege of the Donbass, that will be posted Wednesday at thenation.com. We will discuss the dangerous dynamic driven by hawks in both Moscow and Washington that is inflaming the volatile situation in Ukraine and an apparently detached President Obama who does not appear to have the counsel of wise and seasoned statesmen at this moment of crisis where urgent diplomacy is needed instead of incremental confrontation. Then finally, we will look into congressional deliberations on the crisis at the border following the influx of unaccompanied children from Central America that appear to be aimed at removing due process provisions in the law in order to fast-track deportation of the minors. Doris Meisner, the former commissioner of the U.S. Immigration and Naturalization Service under President Bill Clinton, joins us to discuss the fate of any form of immigration reform in this election year in which humanitarian concerns appear to have been trumped by political grandstanding. And joining us now is Lawrence Lessig, who's the director of the Edmund J. Safra Foundation Chair for Ethics at Harvard University and a professor of law at Harvard Law School. Previously, he was professor of law at Stanford Law School and the University of Chicago Law School and clerk for Judge Richard Posner on the Seventh Circuit Court of Appeals and for Justice Antonin Scalia on the United States Supreme Court. Welcome to Background Briefing, Lawrence Lessig.
Thank you for having me.
And you have formed the May Day Super PAC, which is crowd-funded political action committee, along with Mark McKinnon, a former advisor to President George W. Bush. And is this in the spirit, if you can't beat them, join them?
No, we're going to beat them. We're going to use their techniques to build a movement that will elect a Congress that will pass fundamental reform in the way campaigns are funded by 2016. We think that they've left a window open to change the system, and we're climbing right through it, and we're going to build the movement to change it.
And is having Mark McKinnon aboard, is that a way to try and reach out and make this issue bipartisan? Because campaign finance reform tends to be seen as a liberal and progressive cause as opposed to a conservative one.
I think that when you call it campaign finance reform, you're right. But we think of it as corruption reform. And corruption reform resonates just as strongly on the left as it does on the right. Now, Mark McKinnon's part of this movement because he has for many years been pushing on the right to get Republicans to recognize the need to change the way in which elections are funded. He and I have been conspiring about this in lots of different ways for many years. And with this opportunity, we think that we have a chance to begin to build a genuinely cross-partisan movement because this is not a liberal or conservative issue alone. Our view is that the current way of funding elections makes it impossible for either side to get what they want out of government, and so we have to change the way elections are funded.
And just describe the fundamental mechanism here. My understanding is that what you're basically doing is raising funds for candidates who make a pledge not to, in effect, to find a way to get rid of money in politics.
That's right. We envision a two-cycle process. In this election cycle, we're going to be in five races, really piloting the idea to demonstrate to really Beltway politicians that Americans care enough about this issue to vote on the basis of it. If you talk to any mainstream, common, conventional view politician or advisor in Washington, they'll tell you Americans don't care about this, they will not vote about this, so we're trying to prove them wrong about that, so that they begin to focus on this issue and think about how they need to adjust their positions to reflect what we believe the voters care about. So after we run this pilot in these five races and make this demonstration, we want to build a much, much bigger super PAC in 2016 that can run a race in as many districts as necessary to really win a Congress committed to fundamental reform by that election, so that in 2017 the next president can push through the very first bit of legislation that will change the way elections are funded and really give that president the chance to have a Congress that he or she can work with that's focused on, you know, what makes sense to America as opposed to what makes sense to their funders.
And these races that you're supporting with your new May Day Super PAC, Lawrence Lessig, are in key states, obviously, the primary states of New Hampshire and Iowa. You've got Jim Rubens, a state senator in New Hampshire, who's running for the Republican Senate primary against Scott Brown, the former senator from Massachusetts. And you've also got a Democrat in Iowa, Democrat Stacey Apple. What are you learning so far from the support of these candidates and from what's happening in these constituencies?
Right. Well, it's no accident that on the list of the people that we've targeted to release first, we wanted to release the ones that were in the early presidential primary states, because obviously if we're going to be effective in the long run, it's going to be necessary for us to make presidential candidates as interested in this issue as we're trying to make members of Congress or potential members of Congress. But these two candidates are extremely strong for this reform movement. Jim Rubens is literally the only Republican running for Senate who has openly embraced the idea of fundamental reform in the way that campaigns are funded. You know, now a lot of them believe that we need that reform. A lot of them, if you got them around a quiet dinner table, would admit that they that we should have that kind of reform. But Rubens is the only one brave enough to step forward and say it. And he's running against a candidate in Scott Brown, who himself once was a reformer. Scott Brown, when he was a state senator in Massachusetts, supported public funding of elections. When he ran for his reelection against Elizabeth Warren, he endorsed the People's Pledge, which kept independent political action committees out of that election. But now it seems like he's turned his back on reform. And so what we hope that our intervention will do will be to either get Scott Brown to come back to where he was when he supported reform, or get voters to pick a candidate for the Republican nominee who actually supports reform. And Stacey Apple has been, you know, an incredibly important progressive candidate in lots of issues in Iowa. She supported voter-owned elections in the state Senate in Iowa. She supports a constitutional amendment to address Citizens United, and she's recently indicated her support for the Grassroots Democracy Act, which is a federal statute that would achieve small-dollar-funded congressional elections, which is the number one change that we believe has to happen.
Now, this state senator, Jim Rubens, in New Hampshire, he has some ideas of his own, does he not? For example, he's in favor of giving voting-age citizens a $50 tax rebate check every 2 years to be spent on candidate contributions.
That's right. The rebate or voucher proposal is a proposal many Republicans at least are entertaining now, which would radically increase the number of funders to campaigns. And what we hope that does is to shift the focus of candidates away from the tiny fraction of the 1% that they now spend all their time trying to raise money from, to address instead the wide range of Americans who are actually the people that they are supposed to be representing. So this is an innovative way to try to bring about that change. He's not trying to silence anybody. He's not trying to say corporations or unions can't speak in a certain way. All he's trying to do is to increase the influence the ordinary voters have and thereby restore something of the balance that is intended in a democracy.
So starting on Monday, this May Day Super PAC that you've formed is beginning to spend $12 million on an advertising campaign to help elect lawmakers of both parties who support proposals to get rid of big money in politics. And I understand you've raised $7.7 million so far, is that right? Both from Kickstarter, small donors, and to some extent that's been matched by some of the Silicon Valley billionaires like Reid Hoffman, the co-founder of LinkedIn, and Peter Thiel, the libertarian billionaire. Is that how the money's coming in so far?
That's right. We've run these two kinds of campaigns. One has been a kind of contingent Kickstarter-like campaign where we said we're only going to collect your money if we hit our goal. And the first of that was a $1 million campaign we said we were going to run in 30 days, and we hit our goal in 13 days. And then we got that matched. So we said to some large donors, look, would you come together and match the $1 million that was raised through this Kickstarter-like campaign? And six people matched that first $1 million. And then we raised, then we announced a much, much bigger goal that until the last couple days really just seemed impossibly difficult, which was a $5 million campaign in 30 days. And we met that goal about 9 hours early on July 4th. And now I'm in the process of talking to another range of donors. This time, the focus is not so much on Silicon Valley people as on large donors who are willing to say, look, I'm doing what I can for the policies I believe in now, but I would much rather have a system where I wasn't able to spend the kind of money that I am to influence policy. So we want people to spend their money to reduce their political impact, and that's the kind of matching funder that we're in the process of pulling together right now. And when that's matched, then we'll have more than $12 million to fund these campaigns. And if we raise more, then we can think about even more campaigns. But the target right now is to run five campaigns with the budget that we've put together.
Well, Lawrence Lessig, I remember interviewing Buddy Romer, who ran in New Hampshire in the Republican primaries in the last presidential cycle. And I had him also come out to the UCLA Hema Forum and speak. And he was a very powerful speaker. And the thing that was most depressing about it was that this was a great guy, a bipartisan guy, being both a Democrat and a Republican governor. And he had a lot to offer, a lot of energy, a lot of good ideas. And he couldn't get arrested. He could not get onto the debates. And every time he reached the threshold of their requirement, the Republican Party requirements for getting on the debate, they changed the rules on him. And so it seems to me that money is obviously a part of the problem, but isn't it also getting access to these debates for candidates that don't have the big backers?
Yeah, I'm a big admirer of Buddy Romer as well, and had spoken to him early in his presidential campaign. You know, we all wondered whether his commitment to taking no more than $100 from anybody and taking no PAC money would ultimately defeat his opportunity to be an effective candidate. He thought it would inspire people to support him. I certainly was inspired to support him. But I think what it did is it convinced, you know, the politicians and the media that he had no chance to win. So they wrote him off. Now, I know, and anybody who has seen him in a debate knows, that if he had been on stage in one of those, you know, 10,000 Republican debates that there were in the 2012 presidential campaign cycle, he would have swept that field. He would have been the leader of that field. And I'm sure that there are many in the Republican Party who are kind of terrified with the idea of a leading candidate who would have been out there talking about the need to reduce the impact of money in politics. I think they would have thought that was anathema to the Republican Party of 2012. But we think we are all surprised with the games that were played to basically keep him off the stage, and that's really informed my own strategy here, because, you know, what we're trying to do is not tie the hands of candidates who are trying to get elected to Congress. We're not saying we're only going to support people who promise to take only $100 or promise not to take PAC money. We're going to support people who commit to changing the system. So no unilateral disarmament, but let's envision a Congress that could pass mutual disarmament, where we could stop the game of fundraising and spending this incredible amount of time raising money from the large contributors, and instead get back to a democracy where people are focused on getting voters to support them and not obsessively focusing on getting the funders they need to get the voters to support them. And so I hope this is a more plausible strategy than one which basically ties the hand of the candidate, which is what Buddy ultimately did. We've been inspired by Buddy from the very beginning and will continue to be.
Well, just in closing, Lawrence Lessig, I spoke yesterday to an author of a new book about the Koch brothers that tells the whole family history. And it's a very fair-minded book. And as you know, they're huge players in the current money-driven politics that we have here. And one of the differences he pointed out between Republicans and Democrats and conservatives and liberals is that conservative donors, like the Koch brothers, just tend to give the money and they want to win, whereas liberal donors are usually more interested in single issue, you know, the Soros or others. And Soros, of course, is always cited by conservatives as being the kind of Koch brothers of the left, even though I think he's pretty much given up on politics from what I understand. So given that you're dealing with an issue here, is that a part of this balkanization of problem that I'm talking about? Because, it doesn't seem like you're dealing with a single issue. You're dealing with a mechanism by which to defeat a single issue.
Yeah, we're trying to motivate a movement focused on a single problem, which we believe blocks change regardless of what the issue is. So if it's climate change legislation you want, we will not get climate change legislation until we change the way elections are funded. If it's a simpler tax code that you want, we will not get a simpler tax code until we change the way issues are funded, campaigns are funded, regardless of the issue. Until we bring about this change, there will be no change that makes sense for the wide range of important public policy problems America's got to solve. So we think that more and more people are recognizing this, more are seeing that this is a critical block to the ability of government to govern. And they're realizing that that's why we have to sort of step back from the partisan fights about whether we should have, you know, more health care reform or less health care reform, whether we should have simpler taxes or more progressive taxes. Just step back from that for a minute. And let's set up a system that actually gets it, makes it possible for democracy to work again. And then we'll get back to the problems of figuring out what the left and the right are trying to struggle about. That's the objective we have.
Well, I thank you very much for joining us here today, Lawrence Lessig.
Thank you for having me.
Again, I've been speaking with Lawrence Lessig, who's the director of the Edmund J. Safra Foundation Center for Ethics at Harvard University and a professor of law at Harvard Law School. Previously, he was professor of law at Stanford Law School and the University of Chicago Law School and clerked for Judge Richard Posner on the Seventh Circuit Court of Appeals and for Justice Antonin Scalia on the United States Supreme Court. We're going to take a brief station break and back looking into whether or not we're drifting into a war with Russia.
It's the money.
This is a cold war. Do you know what you're fighting for? This is a cold war.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Dr. Stephen Cohen, who's a professor of Russian Studies and History at New York University and a professor of Politics Emeritus at Princeton University. A contributing editor to The Nation magazine, he's the author of a number of books, including Soviet Fates and Lost Alternatives, From Stalinism to the New Cold War, and The Victims Return, Survivors of the Gulag After Stalin. He has an editorial co-authored with Katrina Vandenhoevel, War with Russia? Kiev Siege of the Donbass, that will be posted Wednesday at thenation.com. Welcome to Background Briefing, Dr. Stephen Cohen.
Thank you.
And are we trapped in a kind of reciprocity where the momentum is with the hawks on both sides here, both in Moscow and in Washington? You know, there have been analogies, of course, made to the 100th anniversary of the beginning of World War One, how miscalculations and the lack of robust diplomacy can lead the world into a catastrophe of unintended consequences. So what's your reading on the overall, this dark picture that your editorial portrays?
I think that your question was actually two questions. One was whether we should think in terms of how World War One inadvertently or incompetently broke out and whether we're in such a situation today. The problem is I don't know enough about that prehistory of World War One to make the analogy. Let me go then to what I think is the second part of the question. Are the hawks, that is, those who seem to yearn for more confrontation between the United States and Russia, ascendant both in Washington and Moscow? About Washington, I think there's no question, because there are nothing but hawks in Washington, in the White House, in the State Department, in the Congress, in the mainstream media, by which I mean, for example, the New York Times, the Washington Post, the Wall Street Journal, and that extends all the way through cable television to the so-called progressive network, MSNBC, which is every bit as hawkish as, for example, Fox cable television. So we have no, at least if we have them, they aren't visible and they aren't audible. We can't hear them. I would say they're no more in the mainstream than perhaps four or five people who have protested and dissented from this American policy, which we believe is driving us already into a new Cold War with Russia and possibly into an actual war. And I even ought to amend that. There were four or five of us back in February. We may now be down to one or two. We simply aren't welcome. And this is unprecedented in my lifetime, and I've lived a long time, because in the past, whenever there was the looming possibility of war, not only with Russia, even with Iraq a few years ago, dissenters and protesters were audible and visible on television. That's not the case. Moscow, the situation is somewhat different. You have to begin with how we got here. The American narrative is that Putin caused all this, his aggression. But all this came out of the unwise American-European policy of trying to force an elected Ukrainian president, Yanukovych, back in November, to make a choice between partnership economic with Russia or Europe and the West. And Ukraine being, for a very long time, centuries, certainly decades, a country profoundly divided between East and West, that was a reckless thing to do, and push led to shove and one thing to another. And now we are where we are. So in Moscow, the perspective is this, that in the beginning, the people we would call doves, those who believe that this is a misunderstanding and it needs to be negotiated out of, and that's fully possible, they were ascendant. They were ascendant, however, until about May, when it became clear that the Kiev government, which is backed 100% by the United States and came to power illegally, made a decision to wage war against that part of Ukraine that favors or has affinities with Russia, the Donbass, southeastern Ukraine. And that war has intensified. Kiev has refused to negotiate with the rebels. Russia calls for negotiation. That has failed. As we talk right now, Ian, Donetsk, the center of Donbass, is under siege. The city's being bombed, shelled, and mortared. I believe those are war crimes. But whatever the case, it's clear that Kiev thinks it can take the Donbass. So now the hawks in Russia, and we've seen this in print, and if you watch Russian television, you'll hear it, are telling Putin, whom I think is a kind of centrist in this dispute, you either fight in Donbass today or you will fight in Crimea tomorrow, because Crimea is now part of Russia. They're headed for Crimea, he's being told. And therefore, the hawks in Moscow are arguing for a direct Russian military intervention in Ukraine and immediately. So they were not ascendant, the hawks in Moscow. But in reaction to events in Ukraine, they now are. And that's why my wife and I, Katrina Vandenhoevel, she's the editor and publisher of The Nation, have written this editorial, which comes up tomorrow, called War with Russia? Because we think we might be getting close.
Well, it does seem, though, that the way that this is being followed by the U.S. in terms of its strategy, if there indeed is a strategy here, is incremental. In other words, they're telling us now with these increased EU and US sanctions that they're actually holding back on worse to come as further punishment from Russia if it crosses the border.
And clearly, it seems pretty clear to me that the Russians are simply not going to stand by and have the Ukrainians defeat what rebels or whatever you want to call them in the eastern Ukraine. They made it pretty clear in terms of reciprocity. So, again, not wanting to confuse World War One, but I'm looking for diplomacy. I mean, yesterday I spoke with the former vice chair of the National Intelligence Council, Graham Fuller, who told me privately that he's terrified, that he just doesn't think there are people in the United States government that have the gravitas and stature to understand how dangerous this situation is and how to steer us out of it as opposed to dig a hole deeper.
Well, that's absolutely fascinating because by coincidence, and I will not mention his name, but a very old friend of mine, about my age, we've been friends for 35 or 40 years, who spent many years at the highest political levels of American government, and is very, very close to the principals, I won't mention their names either, of this administration, of the Obama administration, though it's not Obama. He spoke to these people yesterday, and he came exactly to the same conclusion as Mr. Graham Fuller, because I asked my friend, what is their end game? Do they actually want, because this is in my mind, it's a question, it's not an answer, I'm a person who asks questions. Does the Obama administration want to provoke Putin into a war in Ukraine because they think this is the OK corral, the time has come for a final showdown with the despised Putin and a resurgent Russia? Or maybe, to give them the benefit of doubt, they intend to negotiate, but they want Kiev to be in a stronger military position. And my friend, having talked to these two people directly on the cell phone, says it's neither. It's complete incompetence. They stumble from one non-decision to another. They don't know what they're doing. I said, where is the intelligence? I mean, the CIA knows what's going on, and there are sensible people in Washington whose business it is to deal with facts, not with ideology. He says they're cut off. They're cut off at the State Department. They're cut off at the White House. I said, this is very bad. He says, it's terrible. So that's not my answer. That's not that's simply the way that a Washington insider sees the situation. You know, there are other things we have to mention here. How would we get to war? Well, it would go like this. If Putin enters Ukraine directly, and it could take two forms, what was being discussed in the Kremlin until the Malaysian airliner went down was to declare a no-fly zone over eastern Ukraine, using the precedent that the Americans used in Libya, which the Russians allowed to happen and felt it was betrayed because it became not a no-fly zone, but an assault on Gaddafi leading to his assassination. But to send Russian warplanes over eastern Ukraine and shoot down any Ukrainian planes or artillery on the ground or tanks that approached the Donbass. So it would be a limited military action. Now, of course, the hawks are demanding even more. But in either of those cases, Ian, what we have to ask ourselves, in light of the very large NATO military buildup in eastern, central Europe and the Baltics, if NATO would then enter western Ukraine, and if that happened, you would be at the Cuban Missile Crisis, eyeball to eyeball. And then I would ask one other question. Thanks to history or God, during the Cuban Missile Crisis, we had real statesmen in charge of our destiny. I see no statesman in Washington, D.C. I see one statesman in Europe, Merkel, the Chancellor of Germany. And surely, whether we like him or not, Putin in his 14 years has proved himself to be a major actor on the world stage, what we call a statesman. One other point. In the past, we always knew that American presidents, in time of crises, turned to so-called gray-haired elder statesmen outside the administration. We knew who they were, and we were relieved because they had different points of view, they had experience, and so they gave the president an array of perspectives and choices. So far as I know, Obama talks to no one outside the administration. Absolutely no one. And I could name, but I won't, two very senior American statesmen. Whether we like them or not, they certainly are people who know what they're talking about, that he has declined to see.
Is one of them Henry Kissinger?
I've heard that.
Well, that's what I understand. I mean, in fact, I spoke once a while back with Strove Talbot, and he's still in favor of keeping NATO membership on the table vis-a-vis Ukraine. As you know, Stephen Cohen, the foreign minister of Poland, was recently caught on a tape basically saying that NATO membership is worthless. And it turns out that in the case of Strobe Talbot, who, of course, was Clinton's guy in Russia during the Yeltsin years, he still felt that it should be kept on the table. And I said, but Henry Kissinger thinks it should be taken off the table. I mean, isn't it surreal to think we're in a situation where the Democratic hawks are more reckless than Republican hawks?
It is. And Brzezinski, whatever you think about him, and I, though he was once my professor, have mixed feelings about him. He has said, though he's a very much a Ukrainian partisan, that Ukraine should not be a member of NATO, that Ukraine should have the status of Austria or Finland. It should be non-aligned. So when we hear somebody like Strobe Talbot, but remember what's involved with Strobe Talbot. He was Clinton's Russia hand. He designed and helped implement, hands-on, the Russia policy of the Clinton administration, which has led us directly to this crisis. Remember, it was the Clinton administration that broke the promise to Gorbachev that NATO would not expand and began the expansion of NATO. Bush, the second Bush, and Obama have simply followed that. But there is absolutely certainly a faction, whether in Brussels, Washington, or Poland, or Lithuania, because they've been very active, probably in all these capitals, that is determined to bring Ukraine, and not only Ukraine, Georgia, into NATO as quickly as possible, violating, by the way, all the longstanding preconditions for NATO membership, even leaving aside the reckless consequences that might entail. I think we're in the worst, certainly the worst American-Russian crisis since the Cuban Missile Crisis confrontation, and this might be the worst international crisis, generally far more serious, I would argue, than what's going on in Gaza, which I abhor, or involving Syria or Iran, because those will affect regional outcomes. This is global. We are already in a new Cold War, and Russia has options, China being one of them. This is not some sidebar. This is the destiny, the fate of our children and our grandchildren playing out there as we talk on the phone.
Well, again, I'm speaking with Dr. Stephen Cohen. He's a professor of Russian studies and history at New York University and a professor of politics emeritus at Princeton University. But what I find alarming, if anything could be more alarming than what you just said, Stephen Cohen, is that occasionally, President Obama just doesn't seem to be there, as in that first debate with Mitt Romney. And it seems to me that we are in such a grave situation now, you cannot have that kind of casual detachment. And as you pointed out, he's surrounded by a bunch of lightweights. Most of his closest advisors, with due deference to the fact that you're an academic, come out of academia. They don't have the kind of street creds and understanding and history that I think you need in these situations, not to mention the gravitas of seasoned diplomats. And all up and down the line, I don't see anybody in that administration. And he seems, to many ways, he's outsourced this to Joe Biden and to John Kerry, that there's a curious detachment here. We're playing with fire at the moment, and I don't feel that the United States is engaged.
I feel exactly the same way. I voted for President Obama twice. I did so because I grew up in the segregated deep south of the United States when there was, in effect, a system of American apartheid. And I thought that the election as president of a black American was a form of historical justice. So I voted for him. And I have been very disappointed. I think politics here lies in personality. The detachment is hard to explain, especially when, with maybe 2 years or less of his presidency left, this is his defining moment. This is what Roosevelt called his rendezvous with destiny. And he seems to flee destiny, either because he doesn't care for foreign affairs, he despises Putin, he believes in the righteousness of his policy, or all he wants to be president of is domestic affairs, but it doesn't work that way. Now, you said when you brought up the question of Obama, could things even be worse than I described? And yes, there is one thing that's not reported in this country. Though Obama made an unwise statement in this regard as well. The Russian position has been, since the 1990s, that their conventional military equipment is far inferior to NATO's. Now, that's less so 20 years later. Putin's poured a lot of oil revenue into the military, even since they won but fought an inept war in Georgia in 2008. They are a lot more efficient, a lot more modernized. They have a lot better class of sergeants and lieutenants and people who actually command. The Army's much better. They can fight. But in terms of modern conventional weapons, both in their sophistication and their quantity, Russia is inferior to NATO. Obama said about 4 or 5 weeks ago in public something no president should ever say if he was properly informed. He said, Putin can't do anything because their weapons are inferior to ours. The point is that Russia's changed its military doctrine. It permits the use of nuclear weapons if Russia is overwhelmed. That was added in the 1990s, and nobody paid much mind to it. But the reality is that Russia has about, I'm not sure about the number, about 10,000 so-called tactical nuclear weapons. We, I think, have 400 or 500. It's not the number that's important. It's their history. Obama wanted to negotiate with Putin 4 or 5 years ago, I guess, 3 or 4 years ago, to get rid of those. And the Russians would not even discuss it. It was out of the question. They're happy to cut the big weapons no longer, but they were then. But the point is, those tactical weapons are their rainy day bank account, militarily speaking. Because if they're overwhelmed, their doctrine permits them. Now, tactical nuclear weapons are so-called battleground nuclear weapons. They have a range of, I guess, 100 to 500 miles, something like that. And they can be fired by regular artillery weapons. They don't need, you know, sophisticated missiles or airplanes or anything. But they are radioactive nuclear weapons. As we talk, Ian, this is being discussed openly in Moscow. In the specialized military journals and newspapers, they're playing out various scenarios that nobody wants to, but Russia might have to if NATO comes to Ukraine or crosses Russia's borders, resort to this. Now, bear in mind that the Kyiv government is our government, politically, financially, militarily, and Kyiv has been firing on Russian territory for 4 or 5 weeks into Rostov province, where all the refugees are. They killed somebody, I think it was on July 13th. That's a terrible provocation to be shelling a neighbor's territory, almost as though somebody wants to provoke Russia, but they're playing with nuclear fire. And that's why we need Obama's attention, full attention.
Well, Dr. Stephen,
we don't know where the tripwire is.
Well, but there's a historical precedent, and one of the things that's scary about this situation is that it's all about perceptions. And throughout the Cold War, we never understood the Soviet Union's perceptions of us because we saw ourselves as being virtuous and them as being the aggressors. And we almost had a nuclear war in November of 1983 during the Reagan administration. But what was important about the Able Archer situation back then was that President Reagan understood, the actor understood the danger of the words that he was taunting the wounded bear with, and he became, the hawk became a dove, and then eventually when Gorbachev came along, they brought about a peace. So it's really possible for leaders to seize the moment and
Absolutely. To
take us in a peaceful direction Absolutely. As opposed to dig the hole deeper. And
I have written a political biography. I've been interested academically in political leadership, mainly in Russia and the Soviet Union all my life. But we have in America, as you pointed out, cases of, I think somebody said, politicians who rose above their former self in times of crisis. You mentioned Reagan, who came to power as a Cold War hawk, but had a insight into Gorbachev. He saw an opportunity. He seized it. And when Reagan left office in January 1989, he wrote in his diary, "We have ended the Cold War." So he believed in January 1989. His greatness came at the end of his presidency. but he seized the opportunity. But think back to Lyndon Johnson, a bigot, a racist, a segregationist. But in the crisis this country found itself in, during Kennedy's presidency and after his assassination, Johnson, a Southerner who had built his career on segregation, rose and passed the greatest civil liberties, civil rights bill we've ever had in America. So it is not only possible, it is necessary. And this is how leaders enter history. So it's Obama's moment of truth. But if he's isolated, he may not even understand that.
Well, Dr. Stephen Cohen, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Again, I've been speaking with Dr. Stephen Cohen, who's a professor of Russian studies and history at New York University and a professor of politics emeritus at Princeton University. He's a contributing editor to The Nation magazine and the author of a number of books, including Soviet Fates and Lost Alternatives, From Stalinism to the New Cold War, and The Victims Return, Survivors of the Gulag After Stalin. He has an editorial co-authored with Katrina VandenHeuvel, War with Russia? Kiev's Siege of the Donbass, that will be posted Wednesday at thenation.com. We're going to take a brief station break. We'll be back talking with the former commissioner of the U.S. Immigration and Naturalization Service about the children crossing the border.
From Russia with love I fly to you, much wiser since my goodbye to you. I've traveled the world.
This land is your land, and this land is my land. From California to the New York Island, from the Redwood Forest to the Gulf Stream waters, this land was made for you and me. As I went a-walking.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Doris Meissner, who's a former commissioner of the U.S. Immigration and Naturalization Service under President Bill Clinton and a senior fellow at the Migration Policy Institute, where she directs the Institute's work on U.S. immigration policy. Welcome to Background Briefing, Doris Meissner.
Thank you.
And it looks as if the House bill now is going to, and it's not determined yet, but it looks as if they're going to try and remove that provision that allows for the Health and Human Services to first vet these children from this influx from Central America crossing the border. And the change will mean that the children will now be interviewed by the Border Patrol, and therefore this impediment, as some see it, will be removed, the deportations will be fast-tracked. Is that where we're heading?
Well, that's one way of reading what they've done in the bill. What they're trying to accomplish is treating all young people, all people under the age of 18, in the same way. And so the procedures that had applied to contiguous countries, which would be Mexico and Canada, would now apply to people from all countries. Now, in the case of young people that come from primarily Mexico, that's by very, very great majority the country that has been the distinctive one. It's not Canadians, but it's Mexicans. Those young people do get a very cursory screening. The Border Patrol is required to ask them if they're under the age of 18, whether they have been trafficked, whether they understand the implications of being returned voluntarily to their country. And so there would be a slightly more careful questioning of people under the age of 18 as there would be adults. But that screening that's done by the Border Patrol, most of the reviews of it have shown that it really doesn't give young people any real chance. Or it's not even that they don't have the chance, it's that they just, it's all hurried and they're not nearly as willing to trust law enforcement officers in uniforms as they might be social services people several days after they've actually been in the country and had a chance to have a meal and some rest and so forth. It's not easy for young people. It's not easy for anybody, but it's not easy for young people to tell their story if they really have been badly treated, trafficked, for instance. However, that is where the House bill would place, that's the changes that the House bill would make. That said, we don't have any indication that the Senate is prepared to accept that language. So although this is a proposal from the House, for it to become law, it would need to also be enacted by the Senate and signed by the President, and that's not clear. That's not a clear path right now either.
And in terms of the White House, what is there's been rumors that the White House may compromise on this issue. What's your understanding on where the White House stands?
Well, I haven't seen anything just in the last hours about the White House's stance. The White House, the administration did say several weeks ago when it presented this funding proposal to the Congress that it hoped for some additional flexibility, that's the term that was used, in implementing this law. So the administration did open the door for some possible changes in the law, but I'm unaware that there's been anything more specific than that.
Well, it does seem, though, that that this has become a political football, and this is, of course, an election year, so perhaps that's inescapable. But one of the aspects of the politics of the moment, of course, is Governor Perry of Texas going down to the border and having the Texas National Guard patrol the border. My understanding is that the issue here with these this influx of children is not as if they're trying to sneak into the United States as undocumented immigrants, but rather that they are surrendering themselves at the border. Is that what's happening?
Well, yes, and I think that's an extremely important point. I mean, I really don't think that this is a crisis of border enforcement. That may sound counterintuitive, but this is really a crisis of a lack of judges and a lack of timely hearings. These crossings are happening basically in one place, South Texas, one sector of the border. All along the rest of the border, apprehensions continue to go down. They are at historically low levels. They're lower than they were in the early 1970s when illegal immigration in the current era really began in earnest. This is an issue where, as you say, young people are coming to the border and crossing in ways that, with the help of smugglers who tell them how to cross and where to cross and what to say when they do cross, wanting to be found by the Border Patrol and either walking right up to them if they see them across the river or waiting in places where they have been advised the Border Patrol will soon be patrolling. The reason that they want to be found is because the procedures that are in place for handling young people do ultimately lead to release, generally to family members, and then many, many months and in many places years of waiting for the immigration hearing to take place, which the law states that they have a right to have. So the circumstances are one where the decisions that are made to determine those who have a right to stay in the United States vis-a-vis those who are to be returned to their countries, those decisions made by immigration judges take a very long time. And that's the circumstance, or that's the set of circumstances that has led to word of mouth within the immigrant networks going back into the Central American countries that have led people to conclude that this is a good time to try to come. That's not a border enforcement crisis. That's a crisis of decisions and the resources to make decisions on the claims that these young people may have. This is clearly a mixed flow. It is a flow of young people that are most of them living in dire circumstances in their home countries. Many of them are seriously threatened with violence. Many of them probably have claims for relief in the United States. But it's a mixed group, and distinguishing which ones should be allowed to remain and which ones need to be returned, that is the set of delays that has really contributed, in addition to the dangerous conditions in their home countries, to this emergency.
Again,
not something that that sending the National Guard to the border is going to in any way respond to. But the House bill does, at least the amendments to the House bill that are in play today and tomorrow, do say that where National Guard is to be used, it is not to be used for the traditional tasks that the Border Patrol carries out. It's not to be used for enforcing the law, because that's not what the National Guard is trained to do.
So given the election year theatrics going on here, and perhaps even the case of Texas with Governor Perry, presidential year theatrics, the border itself is more police than ever, is it not? I mean, the argument that this is a problem of needing more interdiction at the border as opposed to better means by which you can deal with a humanitarian problem. Is that what – that seems to be the way the argument is polarized between
that? Yes, that's definitely – you know, many people have framed this issue now as an issue of the borders not being in control and the need for more border enforcement. And I think that is not in any way supported by the facts. I mean, border enforcement has been – very heavily resourced for more than 10 years, actually going on 20 to 25 years, increases steadily over all of that time with support from both of the political parties. I'll just give you one number. The increases in border enforcement since 9/11 have been 300%, whereas the increases in the numbers and allocations of funding to judges for immigration hearings has increased only 70%. So we have a tremendous bottleneck in the system where hearings and judge time and resources are concerned, and that's where the real problem has been for these child migrants, because they have a right to a hearing, and those hearings are deeply backlogged for insufficient resources.
So the idea then that the president is being charged with somehow encouraging these children through loopholes that he is somehow responsible for, that all seems a little excessive. But what is it, though, in this $3.7 billion that the president is asking for? Where is that money to be spent? Because that's not small change.
No, that certainly is not small change. And it's clear that if the Congress does pass a supplemental, it will be significantly less than that $3.7 billion. But what the administration asked for was primarily money for the Department of Health and Human Services to care for these young people, facilities primarily. The $3.7 billion, $1.8 billion of that was to go to Health and Human Services, because they have the responsibility for housing and taking care of these children until they are released while they're processed. And with that, under the statute, comes a requirement that they get health screening and absolutely be sure that they are well. And during that time, Health and Human Services tries to determine if there is a family member in the country who can take care of them, those sorts of things. The rest of the money, another part of the money, goes to the Department of Homeland Security, but not for border enforcement. It goes for the Border Patrol, but for the additional overtime and all of the additional expenses that come in this one sector of the Border Patrol, South Texas. It's called the Rio Grande Valley, for handling this emergency. And then there are substantial lesser amounts, but still substantial funding for increasing the immigration judges, which is really now getting past immediate responses into responses that will make a difference with this flow, because these young people need to have their hearings. And then there is several hundred million dollars for Central American assistance to support reintegration and repatriation programs when people are sent back, when young people are sent back who don't have a right to stay in the United States, as well as assistance for these countries to begin to make it possible for some of these young people to go to school for longer periods of time and improve the security and in the parts of the country that are so in the grip of violent gangs and criminal organizations. So the supplemental does have things in it which go to the longer term causes of this crisis, and it would be a shame if those drop off the table in these negotiations. What I've seen right now about the House cutting of the appropriation does cut out the foreign assistance. It does keep in some of the funding, considerable amount of the funding for the judges.
So just in closing then, Doris Meiser, we've discussed the extent to which politics have intervened in this issue over the sudden influx of unaccompanied children from Central America into the United States in this election year, and then further in the presidential election year with the governor of Texas putting the National Guard on the border when apparently it's completely unnecessary in this case. But aren't the election year follies likely to get worse here, because there's a rumor now floated by a senior advisor to the White House, Dan Pfeiffer, that the Obama administration is planning a very significant large-scale immigration reform sometime before November's midterm congressional elections on the basis that the president is fed up with a lack of progress in Congress and is going to do something unilateral. There's even suggestions that he's sort of like in that movie Dirty Harry, go ahead and make my day. You know, he's sort of saying, I'm going to do this and impeach me if you want, you know. So do you expect things to even get sillier?
Well, it certainly is going to get more tense in the lead up to the elections, and the administration president himself has said and continues to reinforce the idea that he wants to take a big action. That would, of course, be on a parallel track with the continued response to this child migrant emergency. But it's clear that the administration is ready and discussing in a debate internally on what it is that the president can do within his executive authority to ease the difficulties that come about as a result of the Congress being unwilling to enact changes to our immigration law that most people in the public and most people in political leadership understand are essential but have been held up by politics.
Well, I thank you very much for joining us here today, Doris Meisner.
Thank you.
Again, I've been speaking with Doris Meisner, who's the former commissioner of the U.S. Immigration and Naturalization Service under President Bill Clinton and a senior fellow at the Migration Policy Institute, where she directs the Institute's work on U.S. immigration policy. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com, where you can scroll down on the right-hand side to subscribe to iTunes podcasts. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.